From Intellijix, this is Intellijix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. There is a moment, investigators would later say, when everything about Craig Rabinowitz seemed exactly right. The grief was textbook, shoulders shaking, voice cracking at all the appropriate intervals. He told the first officers on the scene that he had come home to find his young wife Stephanie unconscious in the bathtub of their comfortable suburban home, that he had pulled her out, that he had tried to revive her, that he had no idea at all, how something like this could happen to a healthy 29-year-old woman. He was, by every outward measure, the picture of a devastated husband. And for a little while, on that April morning in 1997, the people around him believed it. They would not believe it for long. Stephanie Rabinowitz was, by every account from the people who actually knew her, the kind of person who made a room feel warmer simply by walking into it. She had grown up with a closeness to her family that carried over into her adult life in visible, daily ways, phone calls, dinners, the easy shorthand of people who genuinely like each other. She and Craig had married in 1992, and when their daughter Haley arrived, Stephanie folded herself into motherhood with the same warmth she seemed to bring to everything else. Friends remembered her as devoted, funny, present. She was the sort of mother who got on the floor and played, who remembered the small details of other people's lives because she was actually listening when they told her. She was also, those same friends noted, trusting in the way that people who have not yet been given reason for suspicion tend to be. She loved her husband. She believed, by all indications, that her husband loved her back. What she did not know, what she had no reason to suspect, was the degree to which the life she thought she was living had been quietly hollowed out from underneath her. Craig Rabinowitz worked as a pharmaceutical salesman in the Philadelphia area. The case, despite what some early reports suggested, unfolded not in San Diego but in the leafy suburban community of Cheltenham Township, Pennsylvania, just north of Philadelphia. He and Stephanie lived in a house in Huntingdon Valley, a house that required a certain income to maintain, in a neighborhood that carried its own unspoken expectations. On paper, Craig was doing fine. In reality, he had constructed an elaborate fiction around a secret that was eating through their finances like a slow fire. Her name was Summer. She was an exotic dancer who performed at a club called Delilah's Den in Philadelphia, and Craig Rabinowitz had become, in the clinical language that investigators would later use, obsessed with her. He spent money on her, extraordinary amounts of money, the kind of money that does not come from a pharmaceutical sales salary without some form of structural collapse happening somewhere else. He told Summer he loved her. He told her, according to later reporting, that he was going to leave his wife. He spent so much money at Delilah's Den that the club staff knew him by name. He spent money he did not have, and then he spent more, and then he began borrowing, and then the borrowing became its own catastrophe, and the catastrophe began to grow in the dark where Stephanie could not see it. By the spring of 1997, Craig Rabinowitz was, according to what prosecutors would later lay out in court documents, somewhere in the range of $500,000 in debt. Credit cards, loans, the specific financial architecture of a man who has been lying for a long time and has run out of room to keep lying. He had also, in the period leading up to Stephanie's death, taken out life insurance policies on his wife totaling somewhere in the range of $1.5 million. That number would become, in the investigation that followed, one of the most significant numbers in the case. It was April 28, 1997, when Craig Rabinowitz called 911. He told the dispatcher he had come home from the gym in the early morning hours. He had a habit, he explained, of going to the gym very early and found Stephanie in the bathtub. He said the water was running. He said she was unconscious. By the time emergency responders arrived at the house in Huntingdon Valley, Stephanie Rabinowitz was beyond help. She was 29 years old. Haley, their daughter, was 11 months old. The medical examiner conducted an autopsy, and the initial findings were, in the way of these things, somewhat ambiguous. There were no obvious signs of struggle. There was no immediately apparent external trauma. The manner of death was listed as undetermined, which is the medical examiner's careful way of saying, "We are not certain." Craig was not arrested. He was not charged. He was, for the moment, a grieving widower with an infant daughter and a community around him expressing its condolences. But the Montgomery County detectives who caught the case were not satisfied with ambiguous. They began, as good investigators do, to look at the circumstances surrounding the death rather than only the death itself. What they found, as they pulled at the threads of Craig Rabinowitz's financial life, was something that did not look like grief. It looked like motive. The insurance policies were substantial. The debt was staggering. The spending at Delilah's den was, once they began documenting it, almost surreal in its scale, thousands of dollars, visit after visit, over a period of years. Investigators spoke with Summer, the dancer Craig had been fixated on. They spoke with people at the club. They reconstructed, transaction by transaction, the financial portrait of a man who had been living a double life and had arrived at a point where the double life could no longer sustain itself. They went back to the medical examiner. With the additional context of what they were finding, the insurance, the debt, the relationship with Summer, forensic pathologists took another look at Stephanie's death. The conclusion they reached, and the one that prosecutors would stand behind, Stephanie Rabinowitz had been drowned, deliberately, in her own bathtub, and the scene had been arranged to suggest accident. Craig Rabinowitz was arrested in May of 1997, roughly 3 weeks after Stephanie's death. The speed of the arrest, relative to the initial uncertainty, reflected how quickly the financial investigation had reframed everything else. Prosecutors charged him with first-degree murder. The theory of the case, as prosecutors laid it out, was as direct as it was devastating. Craig Rabinowitz had killed his wife for the insurance money, money he needed because his secret life had consumed everything he had, and a great deal he didn't. The community around Huntingdon Valley, the world of people who had known Craig and Stephanie as a couple, as a young family with a baby daughter, processed the arrest in the particular way that communities process the discovery that someone they knew was not who they appeared to be. There was shock. There was the retrospective searching for signs that had perhaps been there but had not been read correctly. There was grief for Stephanie, compounded now by the understanding of what her last moments had actually been and who had caused them. Summer, the dancer, cooperated with investigators. She was not charged with any crime. She had not, as far as the evidence showed, known what Craig was planning or what he had done. She was, in the architecture of this case, both central and peripheral at once. The reason for the financial collapse, the inadvertent catalyst for a murder, but not a participant in it. Her cooperation helped investigators understand the timeline and the depth of Craig's obsession, and it helped establish the motive that sat at the center of the prosecution's case. The turning point in the legal proceedings came not in a courtroom moment of dramatic revelation, but in the quiet, practical calculus that happens when a defendant and his attorneys look at the evidence assembled against them and make a decision. In July of 1997, Craig Rabinowitz pleaded guilty to first-degree murder. He did not go to trial. He did not put Stephanie's family through the extended agony of watching her death picked apart in open court. Whether that decision reflected remorse, or pragmatism, or some combination of the two, is not something the record can tell us with certainty. What the record tells us is that he stood before a judge in Montgomery County and admitted that he had killed his wife. The guilty plea meant that certain details of the case, the precise forensic reconstruction of what happened in that bathroom, the full accounting of Craig's financial disaster, were never subjected to the adversarial scrutiny of a trial. What emerged in the plea and sentencing process was, by that point, sufficient. Craig Rabinowitz was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He would not collect on the insurance policies. He would not be with Summer. He would not, ever again, be the man walking through a comfortable suburban neighborhood who seemed, from the outside, to have everything arranged just right. Haley Rabinowitz, 11 months old when her mother died, was taken in by Stephanie's family. Her maternal grandparents and extended family, people who had loved Stephanie with the kind of loyalty that does not expire, made sure that Stephanie's daughter would grow up knowing she was wanted. It was the smallest possible consolation in a situation that offered very few consolations, but it was something. The case of Stephanie Rabinowitz did not disappear after the guilty plea. It surfaced in media coverage, in true crime retrospectives, in the ongoing conversation about financial fraud and domestic violence, and the particular danger that exists when someone with enormous secret debt also holds substantial life insurance on a spouse. Criminologists and domestic violence researchers have noted in the years since that the pattern Craig Rabinowitz embodied, the hidden financial crisis, the secret relationship, the insurance taken out shortly before a suspicious death, is not unique to him. It is, in fact, a recognizable pattern, one that law enforcement and insurance investigators have learned to look for precisely because cases like this one exist. Stephanie's family, particularly her parents, spoke publicly in the years after Craig's conviction about the experience of losing their daughter and then learning the circumstances of how she died. Their words, reported in the Philadelphia area press, carried the weight that only people in that specific position can carry, the weight of knowing that someone you trusted with your child's life decided that her life was worth less than a way out of debt. There is no language that fully accommodates that knowledge. You speak around it and through it, and in time you find that you are still speaking, still here, still carrying her with you. Craig Rabinowitz has remained in Pennsylvania State Prison since his sentencing in 1997. There have been no successful appeals, no legal challenges that have altered his status. His conviction stands. He is, as of the public record available, serving his life sentence. The legal chapter of this case closed with the finality that a guilty plea and a life without parole sentence tend to close things, even as the human chapter, for Haley, for Stephanie's family, for the community that thought it knew this man, remains permanently, irreversibly open. There is something that stays with you about this case, and it is not the financial chicanery or the forensic reconstruction or even the particular cruelty of staging a wife's murder as a bathroom accident. What stays with you is Stephanie herself, a 29-year-old woman who, by every account, was doing exactly what you are supposed to do. She was present. She was loving. She was raising her daughter and trusting her husband and building what she believed was a life. She had no way of knowing that the man she had chosen to build that life with had constructed a separate reality alongside it, one that was burning through money and credibility. And finally, when the options ran out through her, the investigators who worked this case, the detectives in Montgomery County who looked at the financial records and understood what they were seeing, spoke afterward about the importance of looking beyond the immediate scene, of understanding that the context surrounding a death is sometimes as telling as the death itself. Craig Rabinowitz had arranged things to look a certain way. He had arranged his grief to look a certain way. What he could not arrange was the paper trail, the insurance documents, the credit card statements, the accounting of thousands of dollars spent at a strip club while the household finances quietly collapsed. Evidence, in the end, does not perform. It simply is. Stephanie Rabinowitz deserved more than she was given. She deserved a life that stretched forward into the decades she should have had watching Haley grow up, growing older herself, discovering whatever the next chapters of her own story might have been. None of that was available to her. What was available in the aftermath of what Craig Rabinowitz did was justice, not the satisfying, restorative kind that undoes harm. The only kind there actually is accountability, a record, a permanent acknowledgement by the institutions of law that what happened to her was not an accident and was not acceptable and would not be treated as though it were either of those things. That, in the end, is what the case of People versus Craig Rabinowitz became. Not a cautionary tale for the people who loved Stephanie. They needed no cautioning. They had lost everything they needed to lose to learn every lesson there was to learn. It became, perhaps, a record, a piece of documentation that sits in the files of Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, and says plainly, here is what happened, and here is what we found, and here is what we did about it. Stephanie Rabinowitz was here. She mattered. The record says so. Our next case takes us to Clatsop County, Oregon. There is a moment investigators remember long after the paperwork is filed and the courtroom has emptied. A moment when the case stops being a collection of evidence tags and becomes something else entirely. For the detectives who worked the long, grinding years of this investigation, that moment came when a name finally attached itself to a decade of violence. The name was Sean Patrick Gillies, and by the time it surfaced, the damage he had allegedly caused stretched from the Pacific coast of Oregon to the Gulf coast of Louisiana, leaving families fractured and communities quietly terrified in his wake. This is how it began and how it ended. The Oregon coast in late autumn carries a particular quality of light, gray and horizontal, the kind that makes distances uncertain and familiar places strange. It was in that light, in a remote area of Clatsop County, that a passerby noticed something that did not belong in the landscape. What they found would set in motion one of the most painstaking multi-jurisdictional investigations the Pacific Northwest had seen in years. The victim was a woman. She had not died easily, and she had not died in that place. Someone had brought her there to this remote margin of road and scrubland and left her as though she were disposable. The medical examiner's findings were unambiguous. The manner of death was homicide, and the violence visited upon her bore markers that experienced investigators recognized as deliberate, organized, and deeply disturbing. What the detective standing in that gray coastal light could not yet know was that this was neither the beginning nor the end. It was simply the moment the pattern became visible. To understand what was lost, it is important to spend a moment with who these women were, because in cases like this one, the urgency of the investigation can sometimes crowd out the humanity of those at its center. The victims in the Clatsop County investigation and its related cases in Louisiana were, by all documented accounts, women navigating difficult circumstances. Some struggled with addiction. Some lived on the economic margins. Some were known to law enforcement not as suspects, but as vulnerable people cycling through systems that had not always served them well. They were daughters and mothers and sisters. They had histories, childhoods, inside jokes, preferences for particular foods, ways of laughing that people who loved them still remember. This matters. Investigators and victim advocates have long argued, because the social circumstances that made these women more vulnerable also made them, statistically, less likely to receive sustained investigative attention in the early stages. It is a difficult truth that law enforcement agencies themselves have grappled with publicly in the years since. These were women whose disappearances did not always generate immediate headlines, whose absence was sometimes absorbed by communities already accustomed to people falling through the cracks. That they were eventually found, and that their deaths were eventually answered for, is a testament to the persistence of investigators who refused to let the cases go cold, and to the advances in forensic science that gave those investigators new tools at exactly the right moment. The crimes attributed to Sean Patrick Gillies, as documented in court records and extensive investigative reporting, spanned roughly a decade, from the mid-1990s through the early 2000s, and crossed significant geographic distance. Gillies was a Louisiana resident, a man who by most outward appearances occupied an unremarkable life in the Baton Rouge area, where he lived and worked and moved through his days without attracting particular notice. He had a girlfriend. He held jobs. He was, by the accounts of people who knew him casually, an ordinary presence. But court records and prosecutors' arguments would later describe a secret life of profound violence. A series of alleged murders of women whose bodies were discovered in remote locations, bearing evidence of strangulation and other injuries consistent with extreme physical assault. In Louisiana, the cases drew the attention of investigators who noted similarities between the victims. Their vulnerability, their isolation, the manner in which their bodies were disposed of. The geographic spread of the crimes, some in Louisiana, some connected to travel along the Gulf and Pacific coasts, complicated early efforts to see the pattern whole. In Clatsop County, Oregon, the discovery of a victim's remains in a remote area prompted local law enforcement to open a homicide investigation in the mid-1990s. The terrain and the circumstances of discovery. A body transported and left in a location chosen for its isolation were consistent with what forensic investigators call a comfort zone disposal pattern, suggesting an offender with some familiarity with the area or its roads. Evidence was collected carefully, including biological material that investigators preserved and submitted for analysis. At the time, the capacity of DNA databases to connect crimes across state lines was still developing, still finding its footing as an investigative tool. The samples were cataloged and held. Years passed. The case did not close. In Louisiana, the investigation into a series of homicides involving women in the Baton Rouge region was building its own momentum through the late 1990s and into the early 2000s. The victims in these cases shared certain characteristics. They were women who lived on society's margins, women whose deaths might have gone uninvestigated had dedicated detectives not pushed back against the institutional gravity that tends to close files and move on. Investigators from multiple Louisiana parishes began comparing notes, sharing evidence, looking for the thread that connected what they increasingly believed were not isolated incidents, but a pattern of predatory violence. The biological evidence recovered from crime scenes was submitted for DNA analysis and entered into the Combined DNA Index System, CODIS, the national database that allows crime scene samples to be compared against profiles collected from convicted offenders across the country. The database returned a match. The profile connected to Sean Patrick Gillies. It was, by all accounts, one of those moments in an investigation when the air in the room changes. Investigators who had worked these cases for years, who had carried photographs of victims in their files and the weight of unanswered questions in their minds, suddenly had a name, a face, an address in Baton Rouge. Law enforcement moved carefully. Prosecutors have documented in court filings that investigators conducted surveillance, corroborated the DNA finding through additional forensic analysis, and built the evidentiary foundation required to make an arrest that would withstand legal scrutiny. Phone records were subpoenaed and analyzed. Physical evidence connecting Gillies to crime scenes was examined and re-examined. The geographic scope of the investigation, reaching from Louisiana across state lines to the Pacific Northwest, required close coordination between agencies that did not always share resources or communication channels naturally. That coordination, while imperfect, ultimately held. Sean Patrick Gillies was arrested in 2004. The charges filed against him in Louisiana related to multiple counts of first-degree murder. He was, at the time of his arrest, in his late 30s, a man who had allegedly carried this secret across a decade of ordinary-seeming life. The arrest did not immediately answer every question. Investigators in Oregon and Louisiana continued to work through the evidence, attempting to confirm and document each connection between Gillies and the victims attributed to him. The process of building cases across jurisdictions, with different prosecutors and different evidentiary standards, required patience and precision. But the DNA evidence that had triggered the initial identification was, by the standards of modern forensic science, remarkably clear. Prosecutors in Louisiana described it as among the most definitive biological linkages their crime labs had processed. The trial proceedings in Louisiana became the primary venue through which the documented evidence against Gillies was tested and weighed. In the courtroom, prosecutors laid out what they characterized as an extensive pattern of predatory behavior, a series of targeted killings of vulnerable women whose deaths Gillies had allegedly concealed through careful disposal of their bodies in remote locations. The forensic evidence was central. DNA profiles, trace evidence collected from victims, physical indicators consistent with the cause and manner of death documented by medical examiners. Defense attorneys, as is their right and function in an adversarial legal system, challenged aspects of the prosecution's case. They raised questions about the integrity of evidence collection and the reliability of certain forensic conclusions. But the jury ultimately found the biological evidence compelling. The DNA matches were not the product of coincidence or contamination, the jury determined after deliberation. They reflected contact, definitive, documented contact, between Sean Patrick Gillies and the victims whose deaths he stood charged with causing. The jury found Gillies guilty on multiple counts of first-degree murder. The sentencing phase that followed produced a result that will keep Sean Patrick Gillies incarcerated for the remainder of his natural life. He received multiple consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole, a legal outcome that forecloses the possibility of his return to the communities where he had allegedly operated for a decade with impunity. There were appeals. In cases of this seriousness and complexity, appeals are virtually inevitable, and they serve an important function. They force the courts to examine whether proper procedure was followed, whether evidence was handled correctly, whether a defendant's constitutional rights were respected throughout the process. The appeals filed on Gillies' behalf raised procedural and evidentiary challenges, as such appeals typically do. The appellate courts reviewed the record. The convictions were upheld. The sentences stood. As of the time of this reporting, Sean Patrick Gillies remains incarcerated, serving those consecutive life terms. The Oregon connection to the Gillies case. The Clatsop County victim, whose remains were found in those gray coastal margins, was incorporated into the broader investigative picture as the DNA evidence was analyzed and cross-referenced. Investigators working that case were able to connect the biological evidence they had carefully preserved to the profile that had emerged in the Louisiana proceedings. For the detectives who had worked the Oregon cases, some of them for years without resolution, it was a moment of professional vindication, complicated by the knowledge that vindication in a murder investigation always arrives too late for the person who mattered most. The use of the CODIS database in breaking this case became, in subsequent years, a frequently cited example in law enforcement training and policy discussions about the value of DNA evidence retention and database expansion. When evidence is collected carefully and preserved diligently, even in cases that appear to stall, the science can eventually catch what the investigation could not. The Gillies case demonstrated this principle with unusual clarity. It also demonstrated something else, something that investigators and prosecutors in Louisiana and Oregon spoke about in the aftermath with a combination of gratitude and unease. The decade during which Sean Patrick Gillies allegedly killed went largely undetected, in part because his victims occupied the social margins. The mechanisms that might have linked his crimes earlier, robust victim advocacy, consistent cross-jurisdictional communication, earlier expansion of DNA databases, were not fully in place. The case became, in a dark way, a tutorial in the gaps that predatory violence can exploit. There is a particular kind of grief that belongs to the families left by cases like this one. A grief compounded by years of not knowing, by the indignity of having a loved one's death go unexplained and unpunished for so long, by the complicated feelings that accompany a verdict that can feel both like justice and like too little, too late. The families of the women killed in Louisiana and Oregon sat through proceedings that required them to hear forensic details of deaths they had already spent years trying to understand and survive. They deserved resolution. They deserved, in the language that courts and commentators reach for in these moments, closure. Though anyone who has spoken honestly with a bereaved family will tell you that closure is not quite the right word. What they received was accountability, a name, a sentence, a door that closed on the possibility that the man responsible would walk free. That is not nothing. In the long mathematics of violent crime and criminal justice, it is, in fact, significant. The investigators who worked this case across two states and a decade deserve acknowledgement, too. The evidence technicians who bagged and tagged material in freezing coastal Oregon. The detectives who kept files active when institutional pressure pushed toward closure. The forensic scientists in Louisiana who ran and reran the database queries until the match was confirmed. Justice in a case like this one is not a single dramatic act. It is the accumulation of thousands of careful, unglamorous acts performed by people who believed that these women's lives demanded a serious answer. Sean Patrick Gillies sits today in a Louisiana correctional facility. He is, by the accounting of the courts that reviewed his case at multiple levels, exactly where the evidence and the law determined he should be. The communities along the Oregon coast and in Louisiana that lived for years with the knowledge that something violent had moved through their margins and gone unaccounted for have had that account settled, at least in the legal sense. The women at the center of this story, the ones whose names belong on the roster of victims rather than suspects, whose lives were cut short in remote places by someone who believed their absence would go unnoticed, were noticed. Eventually, methodically, and with the full weight of two states' investigative apparatus, they were noticed. It took longer than it should have. That is a truth that the investigators themselves have acknowledged, and it is a truth that should inform how we build the systems meant to protect the most vulnerable among us. But the record is clear, and the record stands. What Sean Patrick Gillies allegedly did across that decade of violence was found, documented, tried, and answered for. The women who could no longer speak for themselves were spoken for in courtrooms where the evidence was laid bare and examined and ultimately judged. In the end, that is what this work is for. Our next case takes us to Mahoning County, Ohio. There is a moment in most marriages when one person looks across the breakfast table at the other and thinks they know exactly who is sitting there. Knows the laugh, the habits, the fears, the heart. Rosemary Iacovino had been married to Serafino for years. She knew him as a businessman, a neighbor, a husband. What she could not have known, what no one around her knew, was that the man across that table had, according to prosecutors, already begun to plan her death. The phone rang in the Mahoning County Sheriff's Office on a day in 2003 that began like any other in Youngstown, Ohio, a city that had seen its share of hard news, a city that had learned over the decades not to be easily surprised. But what investigators heard when they started listening, really listening, to a series of recorded phone calls would surprise even the most seasoned among them. A voice they would come to know well, arrangements being made, a price being discussed. And at the center of it all, a woman who had done nothing wrong going about her ordinary life, unaware that someone had decided, in a cold and calculating way, that her life was worth more ended than continued. This is the story of Rosemary Iacovino, and of the husband who, a jury would ultimately find, tried to have her killed. Rosemary Iacovino was, by every account drawn from those who knew her, the kind of person who made a room feel warmer simply by being in it. She was a woman rooted in the rhythms of the Mahoning Valley, a region of northeastern Ohio shaped by steel and struggle, by close families and tighter communities, where neighbors still knew each other's names and church on Sunday was not a formality but a fixture. Rosemary belonged to that world genuinely and completely. She was a wife, a mother, a presence in the community that surrounded her, someone whose days were organized around the people she loved and the obligations she took seriously. Her husband, Serafino Iacovino, moved through that same world with a certain ease. He was known in the Youngstown area as a businessman, the kind of man who shook hands firmly, who spoke with confidence, who carried himself in the manner of someone accustomed to being regarded well. To the people around them, the Iacovinos were a couple embedded in the ordinary fabric of Mahoning County life. There was, as far as anyone could see, no reason to look beneath the surface. But beneath the surface, prosecutors would later argue, Serafino Iacovino was living an entirely different life. He was involved in an extramarital affair, a relationship he had kept hidden from his wife, from his community, from the people who believed they knew him. And he had, court records indicate, taken out a substantial life insurance policy on Rosemary. Two facts that, taken separately, might mean any number of things. Taken together, as prosecutors would present them to a Mahoning County jury, they formed the foundation of a motive as old and as ugly as crime itself. Money, and the freedom to spend it with someone else. The scheme, as prosecutors laid it out, did not happen in a single dark moment of impulse. It was, they argued, calculated, deliberate. Something that had been turning over in Serafino Iacovino's mind for months before it began to take shape in the world. What transformed it from thought to action, or attempted action, was the involvement of an intermediary, a person through whom, according to court records, Iacovino allegedly sought to arrange for someone to murder his wife in exchange for payment. That intermediary became, as intermediaries in such cases so often do, the fulcrum on which the entire prosecution would turn. Law enforcement had, at some point in their investigation, begun monitoring communications connected to this case. The result was a collection of wiretapped phone conversations, recorded calls that captured, in the participants' own voices, what prosecutors described as the architecture of a murder-for-hire conspiracy. Conversations about logistics, about money, about Rosemary, about what was to be done and when and for how much. These recordings, which would become perhaps the most powerful evidence presented at trial, put Serafino Iacovino's alleged intentions into the record in a way that no amount of circumstantial argument could have achieved alone. It is one thing for a prosecutor to tell a jury what a defendant was thinking. It is another thing entirely to let the jury hear him say it. Rosemary Iacovino survived. The plot, whatever stage it had reached, did not succeed in ending her life. But the investigation that had been quietly building around her husband was about to break into the open, and Serafino Iacovino's two lives, the respectable one the community could see and the other one no one was supposed to know about, were about to collide in a Mahoning County courtroom. The arrest of Serafino Iacovino sent a ripple through the Youngstown area that those who covered the story would later describe as significant even by the standards of a region that had weathered extraordinary criminal histories. Here was not some figure from the margins of society, not someone the community could easily distance itself from. Here was a man known and regarded, a man whose alleged crime cut directly to something people find deeply unsettling, the possibility that the person you share your life with has decided, in secret, that you should not have won. In the period between his arrest and trial, the case drew sustained attention from local and regional news organizations. The details that emerged, the affair, the insurance policy, the recorded calls, the use of an intermediary, were the kinds of details that lodge in the public imagination because they speak to something both specific and universal. Specific to the Iacovino family and the community around them, universal in the fear that the people closest to us are sometimes the people we should fear most. Prosecutors, as the trial approached, built their case on several pillars. The wiretapped conversations were central recordings that, in the words of courtroom reporting from the period, captured what the state characterized as Iacovino explicitly arranging for his wife's murder. The testimony of the intermediary was equally critical. That individual, whose cooperation with investigators had been instrumental in bringing the case to prosecution, took the stand to describe, from the inside, the nature of the arrangement that had allegedly been proposed. The insurance policy on Rosemary's life was presented as evidence of financial motive, and the extramarital affair, the relationship Iacovino had allegedly been conducting in secret while married to Rosemary, was offered as evidence of personal motive, the desire to be free of one life in order to live another. Defense attorneys, as is their obligation and their right, challenged the state's characterization of events. They worked to undermine the credibility of the intermediary, whose own interest in cooperation with prosecutors inevitably raised questions about the reliability of their account. They questioned the interpretation of the recorded conversations. They sought, as defense counsel in such cases always must, to introduce enough doubt into the minds of 12 jurors that a unanimous verdict of guilt could not be reached. The jury was not persuaded by the defense. In 2005, after deliberating on the evidence presented to them in a Mahoning County courtroom, the jury found Serafino Iacovino guilty of aggravated murder. Not of attempted murder, not of conspiracy, aggravated murder. Under Ohio law, a charge that carries with it the most severe consequences the state can impose. The verdict, when it came, was received in the courtroom and in the community with the particular gravity that attends a moment when the full weight of what someone has done, or, in this case, attempted to do, is finally, formally acknowledged. The sentencing that followed was equally grave. The judge imposed a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. Serafino Iacovino, the businessman, the husband, the man the community had known and regarded, would spend the remainder of his natural life in an Ohio correctional institution. He would not be eligible for release. He would not, under the terms of that sentence, return to the world he had inhabited. The conviction did not go unchallenged. In the years following the verdict, appeals were filed, as they are in virtually every serious felony conviction in the American legal system, and as defendants have every legal right to pursue. Those appeals worked their way through the Ohio appellate process, raising legal arguments about the conduct of the trial, the admissibility of evidence, and the sufficiency of the proceedings. The Ohio appellate courts reviewed the record, and in their consideration of the arguments raised, upheld the conviction. The verdict returned by the Mahoning County jury in 2005 has stood through that appellate scrutiny, and as of the public record available, Serafino Iacovino's conviction for aggravated murder remains in effect, his sentence of life without parole unchanged. There is something worth pausing on in all of this, something that the facts of the case, laid out in sequence, can sometimes obscure if we move through them too quickly. Rosemary Iacovino was not a casualty of violence. She survived, and that survival was not accidental. It was the result, at least in part, of law enforcement doing exactly what it is supposed to do, gathering intelligence, monitoring a threat, moving to stop a crime before it could be completed rather than after. In the landscape of cases like this one, cases where a spouse is targeted by the person who vowed to protect them, survival is not the most common outcome. Rosemary's survival is, in that context, meaningful. It is the hinge on which everything else in this story turns. Because she lived, a trial could be held. Because she lived, a verdict could be rendered. Because she lived, a community could be told the truth about what had been planned in its midst. And yet survival does not mean unscathed. To learn that the person you married, the person you built a life beside, had allegedly arranged for someone to end your life for money and for the freedom to be with someone else, is a wound of a particular and terrible kind. It does not leave marks that are visible to others. It leaves marks that are carried privately, that reshape the way a person moves through the world, that alter, perhaps permanently, the ability to trust in the way that most of us take for granted. Whatever Rosemary Iacovino carried forward from this experience is hers, and hers alone, and it deserves to be acknowledged even when, perhaps especially when we cannot fully know its weight. The Youngstown area is a place that has been written about over the years, often in terms of its hardships. The collapse of the steel industry, the economic displacement that followed, the organized crime history that the region spent decades trying to move past. It is a place that knows something about resilience, about continuing forward when the circumstances are difficult, about finding community and meaning in the absence of easy answers. The Iacovino case added another chapter to a complicated history, one more reminder that the most dangerous betrayals are often the ones that originate not from strangers but from within the walls of a home. For law enforcement in Mahoning County, the case represented something to be learned from and, in a certain sense, built upon. The use of wiretap evidence, the cultivation of a cooperative witness, the decision to monitor and document rather than to move too early. These were investigative choices that proved, in this instance, to be the right ones. They produced a record of evidence strong enough to survive not only the scrutiny of a jury, but the subsequent review of an appellate court. In a county and a region where the relationship between law enforcement and public trust has not always been straightforward, a conviction that holds through the appeals process is, at minimum, a data point in favor of the system functioning as it was designed to function. What the case cannot do, what no verdict, no sentence, no amount of legal process can do, is give back the years that Rosemary Iacovino spent not knowing what was being planned. The months during which her husband was, according to the findings of a jury, actively arranging her murder while she went about her life, trusted him, perhaps loved him. Those months belong to her history now, indelibly. They cannot be undone by a sentence of life without parole, however just that sentence may be. They are simply part of what happened. Serafino Iacovino was, in the end, a man who had built something, a reputation, a standing in the community, a life that looked, from the outside, like the life of someone who had done things right. And then, if the jury's finding is to be believed, he decided to destroy it all, or rather, to destroy the person at the center of it, in pursuit of money and a secret relationship he preferred to the one he had. It is a story about the choices people make when they believe no one is watching, about what ambition and desire, untethered from conscience, can lead a person to contemplate, and about the fact that, in this case at least, someone was watching. The phone calls were recorded. The intermediary was cooperative. The evidence was gathered carefully and presented thoroughly. And 12 people in Mahoning County, Ohio, listened to all of it, weighed it, and decided that they knew, beyond a reasonable doubt, exactly who Serafino Iacovino was. Not the businessman, not the respected neighbor, not the husband, the man who had tried, in the coldest possible way, to erase his wife from the world she belonged to. Rosemary Iacovino is still in that world, and that in the end is the most important fact of all. That's three cases for today. From all of us at Intelligix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.